Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In January 2007, then 16-year-old John Audrin stabbed and killed his classmate James Allenson in the bathroom at Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School. Audrin suffers from Asperger's syndrome and a host of mood disorders. And at trial, his lawyers argued that Audrin was in a, quote, psychotic state at the time and therefore legally insane. It took jurors just 12 hours to reach a verdict.
What say, was the defendant guilty or not guilty?
Guilty.
Guilty of what, ma'am?
Guilty of premeditated malice aforethought and extreme atrocity and cruelty.
Essentially, guilty of first-degree murder. And therefore, under Massachusetts law, even though Audrin was 16 at the time of the killing, he was automatically tried as an adult and sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. The Audrin case has once again called into question Massachusetts' juvenile life without parole law. Some say the law is unusually cruel to juveniles, that it takes discretion out of the hands of judges and lawyers, that the brains of adolescents are just different from adults. And so they say juveniles should not be tried as adults. Still others say, what about the victim? What about the family of James Allenson, an innocent 15-year-old who was murdered at school? Why shouldn't an offender serve a life sentence for such a horrific crime? So what do you think? Is it time to change Massachusetts law to no longer try juveniles as adults in first-degree murder cases? Or is this the best way to be sure that justice is served? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also join us online at wbur.org/Boston. We're talking about this today because John Audrin's attorney, Jonathan Shapiro, was in court requesting that Audrin's conviction be reduced from first to second degree murder so that he may be eligible for parole in 15 years. Jonathan Shapiro joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So let me ask you, why exactly are you requesting that that John Audrin's sentence be reduced and why his conviction be changed in this case?
Well, we think that because of John's youth and because of his mental illness, the elements of first-degree murder really weren't present to the degree that would justify the verdict and the sentence in this case. The judge has the power to consider all of the evidence, and if she believes that the result of the jury's verdict was not consonant with justice, she can reduce the verdict. And we think that that should be done because once you consider his youth, the effect of his mental illness, the verdict is disproportionate to the circumstances.
The circumstances being, as we mentioned, that and as you've mentioned, that he has Asperger's syndrome, he has a history of mood disorders, including bipolar disorder, things like that. Has there been a precedent on this matter that judges have actually changed sentences or reduced them upon request or argument of the of a defendant's lawyers?
Yeah, very definitely. There is a specific rule that gives the judge this authority, and although I wouldn't say it's exceedingly common, it's not uncommon for a judge to consider a verdict and to determine that verdict, even though technically supportable, nevertheless is disproportionate and unjust.
Mm-hmm. So if indeed the judge were to grant this, John Audrin's sentence would be changed to some 15 years with the possibility of parole. Is that correct?
Well, it would be changed to a life sentence with parole. parole eligibility in 15 years.
Okay, so but your argument is predicated on the fact that you believe that justice was not served because of Odgrin's youth, you say, and his mental illness. Did you get, I mean, other people disagree and say the jury found that mental illness did not play a role and that by Massachusetts law, youth doesn't matter here. So what's your response to that?
Well, number one, as far as our motion is concerned, we're not arguing that the judge should decide that he was not criminally responsible. We're saying even if you take the jury's verdict that he was criminally responsible, nevertheless, his mental impairments were relevant to the question of whether there was premeditation or whether, in fact, the crime was an impulsive, spontaneous outburst from an adolescent who, it's now well established, tend to be more impulsive, more unable to inhibit their aggressive impulses because of their youth, because of the fact that their brain has not fully developed.
We'll get to that a little later in this segment, but Mr. Shapiro, just last question to you. What was the atmosphere there in court today?
I think it was very appropriate. The judge certainly is a conscientious jurist who listened to the arguments on both sides carefully and took the matter under advisement. I think everybody else understood the situation, and although they may disagree with the outcome, certainly was willing to listen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's important that this is not a choice between one family or another. There's a tragedy on both sides. It's just a question of attempting to do justice.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is Jonathan Shapiro. He is the defense attorney for John Odgrin. Mr. Shapiro, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We also want to say that we invited Middlesex County District Attorney Jerry Leone to join us here, but he declined but issued the statement instead. He said, John Odgrin was found guilty by a jury of 12 people for committing a premeditated, deliberate, cruel, and extremely atrocious stabbing murder of an unknown and defenseless classmate in the school's bathroom, taking away the life of a beloved 15-year-old who had everything to live for. The defendant's trial was fairly and wisely presided over by the judge, and he was defended by competent and very able defense counsel. We remain confident that the evidence at trial was sufficient as a matter of law to sustain the conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the statement from Middlesex County DA Jerry Leone. We are talking about Massachusetts juvenile life without parole law. It's brought to our attention again with the case of John Odgrin. And this is a law that requires juveniles to be tried as adults in first-degree murder cases, and if found guilty, serve life sentences without the possibility of parole. And joining us now is Professor James Allen Fox. He's the professor of criminology, law, and public policy at Northeastern University, as well as a blogger for Boston.com. He recently interviewed Paul and Dorothy Odgrin, John Odgrin's parents. His article was published in yesterday's Globe. Professor Fox, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So let me ask you, I mean, you heard Jonathan Shapiro say that, let's not forget, this is a tragedy for two families, a tragedy on both sides. I don't think anyone out there would disagree with that. So what is how is it that John Odgrin's parents are faring right now?
Well, they had struggles all throughout John's life. They struggled during, much long before his arrest, in trying to get him the right kind of treatment for his Asperger's combined with mood disorder and bipolar and ADHD and depression. And now the struggle is even greater because decisions are now out of their hands. Essentially, the Department of Correction makes the decisions, and they can only try the best they can to see their son stay safe.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, do they believe that that the sentence that their son received was unfair?
Well, I think they, and I don't put words in their mouths, except to say that I think they believe that a first-degree murder without parole eligibility is an extreme. They do believe their son, they don't dispute the need for their son to be locked up. They don't dispute the need for their son to see treatment. Where I believe they draw the line is the idea that there should never be second chances, that after a period of time, with maturation and with treatment, there may be a time when John Ogren can safely walk among us, and that will not in any way diminish the horror and the tragedy of the crime he committed.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's get down to the specifics of the law under which he was automatically tried as an adult. It was a 1996 law, I believe, that mandates that Massachusetts state law, I should say, that mandates that juveniles as young as 14 be tried as adults for first-degree murder cases. There's no discretion allowed by prosecutors or judges. It just has to happen. And if found guilty, they're automatically sentenced to life without parole. So what is your take today on the merits of this law and whether or not it's actually working in terms of justice in Massachusetts?
Well, I don't think it was a good law from the start. It was enacted right after the Eddie O'Brien case. Remember the Somerville youth who brutally stabbed his neighbor? And in an atmosphere of hysteria and anger, this law was passed, and that process tends to produce bad law. Mm. It's overly rigid. It's designed for the worst case of the worst case. And I don't see John Ogden as fitting that mold. Many states around this country are now rethinking their juvenile justice statutes and understanding that kids are not adults. They may look like adults, dress like adults, even kill like adults, but they think like children. And the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed. The U.S. Supreme Court notes that even in the most heinous of crimes, juveniles are just not as culpable as adults because of their lack of development emotionally and neurologically. That doesn't mean that juvenile killers shouldn't be punished. They should be punished severely. And in fact, the law that was in place in the early 1990s was 20 years for first-degree murder for juveniles. They should be punished, but not to the same extent as adults.
Professor Fox, let me ask you. You said that this law in 96 was passed in a atmosphere of hysteria over juvenile crime. And I was doing my research on this, and I found that there are many people out there who said that you yourself, as a very famed criminologist across the country at that time, may have been one of the people contributing to that atmosphere of hysteria, because that was the time, 95, 96, where we had the phrase super predator emerge. And I find a quote from you in Time magazine in 1996 saying, regarding the coming of many juvenile offenders, that this is the calm before the crime storm. So long as we fool ourselves into thinking that we're winning the war against crime, we may be blindsided by this bloodbath of teenage violence that is lurking in the future. So have you had a change of heart since
no,
then?
No, those words are very well put, I should say. What I was calling for, and by the way, super predator was not my term, that was John DiIulio's. I don't believe that juvenile offenders are predatory. They're more impulsive, and they're certainly not super predators like, say, serial killers are. What I was suggesting back then was that we need to invest a lot more than we were in crime prevention and crime control. We invest in after-school programs, so boys and girls clubs, because we had a growing number of at-risk youth who were in single-parent homes, under-supervised, under-socialized, and that was something we had to respond to, even though crime rates were dropping.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought or argued that we should just throw all these kids into the adult court. Rather, we should think preventatively. And in fact, to some extent, that worked. The call I made for after-school programs and talking about what I call the prime time for juvenile crime, the after-school hours, led to the 21st Century School Act through Congress and over $1 billion of money for after-school programs, because kids just shouldn't be on their own on the streets after school.
Well, I want to get another voice in here to argue the other side, because there are a lot of people who believe that maybe this law is okay. It's Wendy Murphy. She is adjunct professor of law at the New England School of Law and director of the Victim Advocacy and Research Group. Wendy Murphy, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's good to be with you.
So your thought on, there is a push. Governor Deval Patrick actually wants to change this 96 law and no longer require trying juveniles as adults in first-degree cases. Your thought on the push to maybe change what we've got on the books right now?
Well, you know, it's always a high-profile case that inspires us to toss out the whole system, and I think that's probably too rash. You know, statistically, and I actually wrote an article about this issue, the United States Supreme Court has upheld the constitutionality of life without parole for juveniles, in part because there's good data out there that tells us, as sad as it is, that there are 17-year-olds who are, in a sense, sociopaths. They will never, ever restrain themselves from hurting others. And so we can talk all day long about why that is, but the question is, should we necessarily invest money in treating them and ultimately take the gamble that sociopathy is fixable and so forth? You know, you have to just look at the data, and the data tells us, sad as it is, and I think the numbers are not huge, but it's certainly there, that you can be 17 years old, commit a horrific crime, and just never be safe to walk around free in society again. Now, I have to say that the other thing that we really have to remember about juvenile justice and juvenile crime is that we've been moving in this direction of transferring them more frequently to adult court and imposing tougher punishments on them, because there was about a 20-year period into the 80s when the primary philosophy in juvenile justice was rehabilitation, rehabilitation, rehabilitation. That was the first line. It was often the only line. And I was a prosecutor at a time when it didn't matter how grotesque your murder was, you would never be prosecuted as an adult if you were a juvenile. And it was because the data we saw in the aftermath of that mindset showed us that we got an uptick in juvenile severe crime. And I want to be clear about this. It wasn't an uptick in crime per se. It was that juveniles were committing much more violent and horrific crimes than ever before in our history. And they were committing those crimes at ever younger ages.
Is this nationwide? Because my understanding is that the juvenile homicide rate in Massachusetts peaked in 1992, and since 98, it's been sort of lower than it has been in a generation.
Sure. It's been lower nationally. And let me also say that many states have reconsidered their statutes. In fact, even Texas has abolished life without parole for juvenile offenders. We haven't in Massachusetts. We have the 10th most people with life sentences for juvenile crimes in the nation. I'm not disagreeing.
Let me have some time, Jamie. I didn't interrupt you. Let me just have some time here, because I want to be clear about something. I'm not saying we should always give up hope for all juvenile offenders, even when they commit homicide. What I'm saying is there's good reason we've been moving in this direction of tougher punishments, and people will argue that the reason we've had a reduction in severe juvenile violence in the recent past is a direct result of those get tough policies. Now, people can argue all day long about cause and effect. I don't think that's really the issue. The issue is, should we completely redesign a system because of one case? And the answer is, of course not.
Professor Fox, it's actually my turn, and I do apologize to interrupt on both of you, because we have a ton of people who want to join this conversation out there. Joe is calling from Stoneham. Welcome to Radio Boston, Joe.
Thank you. Our culture is becoming more and more barbaric. The whole concept of sending a 16-year-old into prison without the possibility of parole denies all of us our life experience. I'm in my 60s. I would have a tough time looking at myself when I was 16 and saying, oh yeah, I understand why I did that. I think every listener who's in their middle ages can look back at when they were 16 and say, God, I did some pretty stupid things.
But you didn't murder someone in the bathroom with a knife, though, Joe.
But to say that there's no possibility of parole denies the possibility of change. And who is the God that is going to make that decision?
Mm-hmm.
It's just barbaric.
Joe, thank you so much for your call, both of you.
What's funny about our conversation...
Wendy, I do apologize. I'm going to let you guys get back in here, I promise, because I know there's a lot to talk about, but the same passion is being felt by our listeners, and I do want to include them in the conversation. Simon is calling from Lincoln. Welcome to Radio Boston, Simon.
Hi. I'm calling. I was a student at Lincoln Sudbury during the time of the murder. I didn't know either the victim or John Ogden, but I feel a tremendous amount of compassion for both and their families. And I'm curious as to whether there's been any long-term study or attempt to quantify and I guess qualify the sense of closure that's brought to victims by long-term incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
What are families that are similar to the Allensons going to be feeling in 20, 30, 40 years is there, you know, any proof that that really is of any benefit to society?
Okay, Simon, great question. Let's turn that first to Professor James Allen Fox, and then Wendy Murphy, I'll let you have your chance here.
Sure. Many families believe that they wish for that closure, and indeed even states where there's a death penalty, they believe they're going to get closure from seeing execution. But generally, it doesn't give them the satisfaction they wish. It doesn't bring their child back. That's really what would make them whole. But let me also just say that we need discretion back in the system. There has always been the possibility of trying certain juveniles, repeat, violent, ruthless offenders as adults, and that's appropriate because they've proven that they're beyond this juvenile justice system. But we need to add some discretion back so that the special cases, the run-of-the-mill juvenile murderer, can have a second chance.
Wendy Murphy.
You know, I have a couple things. First of all, closure is not the purpose of the criminal justice system. Some people may say it gives them a sense of that, but that's not why we punish. We punish to deter, we punish to protect, and yes, sometimes it does give victims a feeling one way or the other, but you know, when a victim's family says, please don't lock him up, we'd like him to be set free, we want him to have probation, the prosecutor and the judge don't just say, okay, well, let's call it a day. It isn't about the victim's feelings alone, and let's be clear about that. And
well,
the data goes both ways.
Actually, Wendy, I wanted to actually add that James Allenson's family, exactly on the point that you make, and James Allenson is the young man who was murdered by John Odgrin, they issued a statement saying, to know James suffered and died alone at the hands of someone else and to live with that knowledge is terrible. To hear that John Odgrin's imprisonment is unfair or cruel when he is the one who murdered our beloved son is unthinkable to us. The defendant should serve his lawful punishment so we can try to have some sort of peace. So in that case, this seems like this family is saying that it is closure for them to know that the law mandates that Odgrin spend his life in prison.
Well, that's exactly the next point I was going to make, is you can't let how someone feels dictate the right result. Otherwise, when a judge gives out a lenient sentence, the victims would be allowed to go in and say, we'd like you to ramp it up a little bit. That's not good enough. That doesn't give us enough feeling of closure. So let's be clear. But, you know, the other thing I think that we forget sometimes is that the mentally ill don't kill in general. And we have to be so careful not to give discounts because someone has some form of mental illness. And although age is also a factor, most juveniles, no matter what they're doing wrong because they're going through a tough time in their lives, they don't kill. So, you know, but having said all that, I personally believe that because Massachusetts gives discounts because of age, and also gives discounts because of what's called the diminished capacity defense, and most states don't, but because Massachusetts does, this child, and I will call him a child, should probably get his sentence reduced to second-degree murder. So I'm not making broad statements without the potential for compassion.
Well, let me drill a little bit more on this point, because you mentioned that the mentally ill don't necessarily commit crimes at any higher rates, and that is true. The science is pretty unequivocal about
that,
especially of Asperger's. I was going to say that there's no evidence that there's greater crimes committed. But what about, there seems to be this new rash of scientific evidence that's coming out, research that's saying it's the teenage brain itself, mental illness aside, completely out of the picture, it's the teenage brain itself that isn't really capable of understanding or processing the consequences of its actions, and based on that alone, we shouldn't be trying kids as adults.
But that's why I just said that teenagers don't kill more often than adults, so you can say that, but it doesn't prove itself out in the data that it's something we should give automatic discounts to because impulsivity is not manageable.
Let me get one more caller in here, okay? Francis is calling from Marlboro. Welcome to Radio Boston, Francis.
Yes, hi, Magna. I'd like to know, how did John get into Lincoln Sudbury High School? It is very obvious, and has been, I've wondered this for 3 years, that he had terrible psychosocial problems, and he should be in a different teaching environment, and his care should have been managed. Why was that not case?
Francis, thank you so much for your call. Let me just turn that briefly to James Allen Fox, who spoke with John Odgrin's parents. The answer to that question, Mr. Fox.
Well, the Odgrin struggled for four years trying to find the right placement, the right school, the right treatment. He had been to programs in Fitchburg and in Belmont and down in Connecticut. And there was a program called Great Opportunities for Special Needs Kids within Lincoln Sudbury High, a program within a program that was supposedly designed to allow kids like John some kind of structure, of a small class setting, even though it's in a big school.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't want to get into the area about who's to blame, because there's a lawsuit going on about that, but only to say that they were very caring people, including the Ogdens and others, who were trying to do the best thing that they thought for John Ogden and others.
We've just got barely a minute to go here, but I do want to ask one last question. Wendy Murphy, you said earlier that you think that in this particular case with John Ogden, given the circumstances, he may deserve to have his sentence changed. But the law really doesn't allow for that as it stands. So do you see a potential for maybe adjusting the 1996 statute that requires us to try certain juveniles as adults and making putting some room, wiggle room in the law? Would that be satisfactory? Would that still allow justice to be served?
You know, I'm going to disagree with the premise because, in fact, the very rule that Jonathan Shapiro talked about at the outset is the very thing that gives the judge the discretion to do what we've all been talking about. If there's a specific case where the judge needs to reduce both the nature of the conviction and the potential and the overall punishment, we have a law in Massachusetts that lets the judge do that. That's the discretion that's already in place. What I hear you saying and what I think I disagree with is the idea that we should redesign the system to say the presumption is all juveniles have the potential for rehabilitation and should always be tried in the juvenile system first. I disagree with that. It's sad but true that some juveniles really cannot be rehabilitated and really should be behind bars. Not too many, but there are enough that we shouldn't redesign the system in its entirety.
Professor James Allen Fox, last words goes to you today.
Yes, I think Wendy and I agree mostly. I would like to presume that kids are kids, and if there's evidence that they're unreachable, then they should be in the adult system. Also remind us that 1991, we didn't give a slap on the wrist for juvenile murder. It was 20 years of first-degree murder. That maybe was a good measure of justice. Maybe we should be going back to that and saving the adult system for truly the very few kids for whom it's appropriate.
That's Professor James Allen Fox. He is a professor of criminology, law, and public policy at Northeastern University. Professor Fox, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And also we were joined by Wendy Murphy. She's adjunct professor of law at the New England School of Law and director of the Victim Advocacy and Research Group. Wendy Murphy, thanks again for being on Radio Boston.
You're welcome.
When we come back, a little probation into the probation department in Massachusetts. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.